I want to talk about two of the orders that I think are legitimately very takeable.
To forge the narrative.
Hey everybody, welcome to Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul, your host. I'm joined tonight by Red Powell.
Hello.
And Adam Camilleri.
Oh, hey.
We are the Bell and Lost Souls podcast. Thanks for joining us, everybody. Please don't forget to like, share, and subscribe. I know some folks, you may be like, do I actually need to subscribe to this? Just please do, even if you don't feel like you need to. We'd love it if you did, and then leave us some 5-star reviews. But I invite you to join us each and every week as we run down some of this stuff. And as I promised, with the cliffhanger of last week's show, I want to talk about the Battle Sanctum from the Adeptus Aureitas Codex.
Well, so when it first came out, I was like, this thing's really good. And I think we were on an episode, probably 6, 8, 9 months ago now, who knows, where I said, this thing's really good because you get to bring a premium piece of terrain with you to every game. And you're just going to have one game. Let's say you go into a 6-round tournament. You have one game out of those 6 where your terrain, your deployment zone terrain isn't as good as you want it. And you just be like, oh, problem solved. Battle Sanctum to the rescue.
I was kind of tongue-in-cheek referring to the awesomeness of the Battle Sanctum, but it's a sizable piece of terrain.
It is. It's coming to some issues now with some of the rulings GW has made about how you place things of this nature when you bring them to a match play game. And I think the restriction is they can't be placed within 6 inches of any other terrain piece, because what people were doing was like what I was referring to before this rule came out, and just like make yourself a nice big 9-inch, 12-inch tall, however big it is, Aegis defense line in front of your army where nobody can see anything in your deployment zone.
It's at least a foot tall. I mean, it's large.
It's a big boy or lady, whichever it may be. What do you think of it now?
This is kind of, I think, a little bit beware. If you're going to include this as a part of your army you want, and you're going to, you're traveling to a tournament, even going to a local tournament, you want to know how the organizers will respond to this because of exactly what you mentioned. If it has to be a certain distance from certain terrain pieces, will you be allowed to move them?
Yes. Pretty much you just need to find out if they're playing with really, really dense terrain, then you're going to have some struggles, especially if they're holding really tight to some of the GW rulings or some of the other known tournament organizer rulings like the WTC or the ITC packets. Yeah, you really want to know what you're getting into before you decide to bring this thing to an event or not.
It's 80 points. And so if there was, and I'm certainly not suggesting or even implying that TO shouldn't try to accommodate this type of stuff, especially when it's a piece of someone's army or something that someone can take and build their list around. Or not, I don't know anyone's going to build their list around this, but if it's included in their points, you know, whatever. You want to know what to expect when you're getting into that. So a little bit of a cautionary advice there on that. But 80 points, it is a terrain feature. After this model is set up, it is treated as an area terrain feature with the following terrain traits as described in the Warhammer 40,000 core rules: breachable, defensible, light cover, obscuring, scalable, and inspiring for Adeptus Minotaur.
So I think me and Red both agree those are all the best ones, right?
I do like dense, but yeah, those are pretty much everything you could ask for.
Yeah, if you wanted a terrain piece, a big chunky couple of level multi-level ruin terrain piece in your deployment zone, these are the keywords you wanted to have. All the good ones. It does some other cool stuff as well. You mentioned inspiring. You want to tell us what that does, Paul?
I'll get to that. Let me run down the thing here. So it's consecrated ground. While a chaos unit is within 6 inches of this terrain feature, subtract 1 from the leadership characteristic of models in that unit. Then as prayers of the saint, while any battle sanctum terrain feature on the battlefield, cult, imperialis, priest, and adeptus auritas units in your army can attempt the following action. Pray to the saint. At the end of your movement phase, 1 cult, imperialis, priest, or adeptus auritas infantry unit from your army that is wholly within 1 friendly battle sanctum terrain feature can start to perform this action. The action is completed at the end of your turn. Once completed, you gain 1 miracle dice.
Pretty good. I mean, if you're bringing this thing, you're probably going to have 5 sisters and maybe a buffing character sitting around it all game. They might as well be standing there doing an action, getting you a miracle dice. It's pretty good value for 80 points as well.
Inspiring is add 1 leadership if wholly within 6 inches.
It's a big terrain piece as well. That's actually a big aura from that.
This thing is massive. When you're looking at the box, you can just tell, like how many sprues and stuff in there. And of course, it has the statue that comes with it. This thing will also look amazing on a display board or just in your themed terrain if you happen to have a personal table.
I love that it's got this little pulpit coming out from the side, like this little balcony. And then if you put Junith on her pulpit on that pulpit, you've got pulpitception, and you know, you could have a lot of fun with that. That should be everyone's terrain. That should be everyone's display board.
Hey, look, it's, when you can get a ready-made display board like that, then why not? So again, this is one of those things to where it's, it looks cool. I don't know that I would include it in most armies. And tell me I'm wrong here.
Red, you want to take it?
Yeah. So I think something to, I mean, first of all, Paul, I'm not going to tell you you're wrong, at least outright.
I appreciate
it. No, but I do think, you know, I've talked about terrain before and the ability to bring something. And I really wish that there was more fortifications like this for all the armies, because I wish that that was something that people, I mean, because there's just so much to this. As Adam stated, it's got all the right traits. It's massive. And you get to pick where to put it to a certain extent. I know that there can be some competitive controversy maybe in how terrain works out and how it gets placed. But a lot of times, I mean, there hasn't been bad consideration when the terrain you see that comes to competitive events can be played. And I really do like that this really plays into the sisters deal, whether it's you know, an Imperium hive city or a backwater world or whatever. Like, the sisters are everywhere. The ecclesiarchy of the Imperium is literally everywhere. Like, there's nothing stopping the illusion of this thing just being in literally any battlefield that the sisters are fighting at. And they do have more of like a custodial role. And so I know all of that to beat around the bush. Paul, I like, for 80 points, it's a hard argument to say why it wouldn't go. Just to be able to control that piece of terrain. Okay, well, we understand where the general objectives are, and I can make my own advantage by putting this obscuring piece of terrain down. Like, what's the issue? Well,
I made a cheeky argument, I think, the last time we talked about this, where I said, if you were good enough at the game and you were good enough as a sisters player, and you knew that if you went to a five or six round big chunky tournament and you had a decent chance of winning, but that one game out of five or six, you're going to get dud terrain. Or, you know, because the variables are there. You might just get a bad, you know, deployment map with not enough terrain features in it. And who knows, maybe you're playing the new ad mech book and they've got, you know, 12 chickens and you're like, wow, I am so screwed if I go second. If you could just pay 80 points in your list to have a game out of that game instead of automatically losing if you go second, would you do it? Some people would say yes. Some people would be like, oh, well, I really need those 80 points. But when you think about what 80 points is going to cost you, you know, is it one unit of Battle Sisters and a couple, you know, it's like six or seven Battle Sisters or a character here, one Paragon Warsuit, a pendant engine or two, you know, it's like, it's not that hard to justify when you put it into that kind of context. But there will be a game where it feels bad, where you're like, I wish I could place that piece of terrain, but I'm not allowed to. And I would really like it this game, and I don't have it. So there is a bit of a give and take there.
You can't get just one Paragon Warsuit. I was being slightly facetious But you guys, you sold me on the fact that no one can take these keywords away from you.
It's true, yeah.
It comes assigned on the data slate.
Exactly right, yeah. There's no removing, unless like there's some, you know, Tyranid abilities. I think they've got an ability to look at a terrain piece and be like, doesn't give you light cover anymore. I think that's what it's translated into.
Oh, sure. Not, I mean, I guess what I mean, no organizer and no labeling and no debating with your opponent about what is on the traits of a piece of terrain, what it does. It's just there. Yeah. I'm sorry. I should have been more clear with special rules and other armies that can ignore special rules by nature of their special rules.
Mm. But man, this codex is... I actually really like this codex. I've had a chance to go through it almost cover to cover now. But what do you guys think off the top of your scalps?
Well, I mean, just for starters, we spent 5 minutes talking about an inanimate object. So even that is remarkable about the book. But yeah, I like it. I think there's going to be some adjustment as people shift away from, you know, if they want to continue playing Sisters, they may shift away from what they were taking previously, but not, I don't think it's by much.
I think this is a great codex for Sisters players out there, because your army, I think we said a very similar thing for Necrons towards the end of the lifespan of their last codex, where it was like, your codex starts with 700 points of it already allocated. I think, right. Red, is that true?
Yep. That that used to very much be the case for the Necrons. You're like, okay, I no matter what troops I take because of the way the Force worked, yep, two-thirds or a third of your list was already essentially decided for you right out the gate for the Necrons. That used to be the case. No longer.
Yeah, I feel like, and I'm speaking strictly from the more competitive lists that I've seen and I've experienced across the table from, they were getting to some level of cookie cutter. And by that, I mean every single list that I saw at a tournament was Bloody Rose, or the vast majority of Bloody Rose. And they all had a combination of Retributors, Zephyrim, and Repentia. And it was just how many of that combination of those three units. Sometimes it was one big unit of Zephyrim, three units of Repentia, two units of Retributors, one unit of Retributors, three of each Zephyrim and Repentia, or two of each. And so it seemed like there was the three auto-take units that everyone took, and then there was just the Misk. And I believe we haven't seen those units that I just talked about be wholesale nerfed. I don't think they've been, you know, tragically nerfed, but I think a lot of their power has been plucked out and redistributed across the rest of the army. Because I look at this faction now, and I roll it down, I look at every single, I'm looking at the data sheets, and there's maybe one or two units in this entire faction that I can't make a good argument to see in a list. And I think that is really good. And that's exactly the same. I said exactly the same things about the Drakari Codex, and I feel similar that Admech's close to that as well. And I think this is just amazing for people.
Can we talk about the Dominion squad for a little bit?
That's because you think they're one of the most improved?
They have improved, but I think they were playable before.
Absolutely, they were. They were, but they were a bit like, remember Red Conspectors as well. People took crypto thralls and little, just points gatherer units that really didn't do anything apart from running up, putting up a banner turn one on the mid board when you wouldn't otherwise be able to. And then you're like, oh, well, I'm dead now. Job done. Now they slap as well.
Before the show, asked you what you thought about the Immolator.
The Immolator. Yeah, some funny stuff you could do with Dominions. So in previous iterations of the Sisters Codex, Dominions used to be able to scout move. Well, they've always been able to scout move, but they used to be able to take their whatever transport they were in with them, and they lost that in the last Codex. But now they've been given it back. So now you can have you can take a Rhino or an Immolator for this job, but. And there's a. I've been trying to find it in the stratagem section, but I read it previously that there's an auto explode. I believe it's Immolator locked. There's an auto explode option for your Immolator, in which case you could scout move five Dominions in an Immolator, and you scout move that up before the game. You go first, jump the Dominions out to do their midboard job, and then move advance that Immolator, or move and fire that Immolator into somebody's face, where they have to kill it. Like, it gets in such a position that they have to kill it, e.g. they have to put enough resources within 6 inches to destroy it, and just blow the thing up and just, ha-ha, suck it, this is great.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about the Dominion squad specifically itself, too, is that it's a squad 5 to 10 models, base cost 12 points apiece. It's a fast attack slot. You're right, they do get that ability through the Holy Vanguard rule to what we would consider scout up the transport a bit, and they get to take what's called an artificer crafted storm bolter.
Yeah, this is new. There's a couple of things new in this codex that we haven't really have a lot of people might not know yet, but sorry, go for it, Paul.
Up to four Dominions can each have their bolt gun replaced with one weapon from the special weapons list. The special weapons list is the Artificer Crafted Stormbolter, Meltagun, and the Ministorm Flamer. The Artificer Crafted Stormbolter has a 24-inch rapid fire 2, strength 4, damage 2 weapon.
Yes. That's wow. And they can have four of them.
Yeah. Now, that very adds 5 strong points per model. So it turns 5 of them into 17-point models. Yeah, 17-point models. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a stratagem that goes along with what I think you're talking about
bolts
here. Oh, my dear God. They are so good for this strat.
All right.
You go for it, Matt.
Use this stratagem in your shooting phase. When an Adeptus Aureatus unit from your army is selected to shoot, until the end of the phase, each time an attack is made with an Artificer Crafted Stormbolter by a model in that unit, on an unmodified hit roll of 6, the target suffers 2 mortal wounds and the attack sequence ends. A maximum of 6 mortal wounds can be inflicted per phase.
Oh, thank goodness.
I love it how we all kind of inwardly do what Red just did when we read out one of these a strat like this, which is like, please be capped, please be capped. Because, it's still really, like, we joke on this, and Paul takes the mickey out of me when I say, I used to pay 1 CP for like a flak missile shot or a hellfire round from Heavy Bolter to do 1d3 mortal wounds from the last codexes. And now this one, on this unit with four Stormbolters, I think someone's done the math, and you're somewhere around the 60 to 70% chance to do all six mortal wounds for this one CP. If you add in some more, you know, here and there or whatnot, but yeah, you have a very, you have better than 50% chance for this one CP to do just six mortal wounds for one CP.
I think that's a little ambitious, only with four rapid fire. I mean, you got to be up close, and you got to be rerolling ones or something like that.
Yeah, with some rerolls and some bits and pieces, because you only need three sixes on 16 shots.
Yeah, sure.
To do the six mortals. Yeah. So and in reality, most of the time, you know, half the time ish, you're going to do four, and for one CP to do four mortal wounds on top of doing all these two damage hits as well, pretty good one CP. Like, it's a very good value one CP.
Well, so let's say that strategy you were talking about for the Immolator is called Martyr's Immolation. Use a strategy in any phase when an Immolator model from your army is equipped with Immolation Flamers is destroyed. Do not roll to see if the model explodes. It does so automatically. That is also one CP. But if you're doing that trick to where you're moving them up, and they're, let me just read out Holy Vanguard as well. At the start of the first battle round, before the first turn begins, this unit or the Adeptus Aureus transport it is embarked in can make a normal move of up to 6 inches as if it were your movement phase. And then you must end 9 inches away. And then if both players do it, then the person who's taking the first turn moves their stuff first. But if you're already planning on closing with these, and that means you're maybe pretty close to rapid fire range, or you're at least 6 inches closer than you were before, and you get a movement phase if you're going first.
Yep.
So I'm having, this is like a recurring nightmare of mine, Rhino rushing Dominion squads. I'm not even kidding, man. Like Immolators and whatnot. There's this great player, this guy I used to play, who he was pretty, I mean, he didn't stop playing Sisters. He still owns original Sisters, right? You know, we were talking about last time, like from when they first released, and their great sculpts and pewter. And he, I don't know if he really has changed over into the new models yet, but I mean, more power to him in how he's stuck with them regardless of the codex and how it's changed over time. But I know it broke his heart a little bit when the Dominion squads lost that ability, and to see this come back, like I think that's a serious concern. There's you know, we were talking about pre-show about how some folks are, and I get it, I totally understand, when things change like this, it is frustrating when you have something that you've been running for a while that you're comfortable with, and the Sisters have been doing well. They may not have been getting the spotlight as much, but they were doing well beforehand. And now
somewhat difficult army to assemble and paint and just like get tournament ready. It had almost a little bit of that Gene Steeler cult effect to it, if you ask me.
Yeah, there was some proper hobby lag, and it came at a time when things were selling out like worldwide in an instant. So actually getting the physical models was a bit tough.
Yeah, sorry, Brad, I jumped in there. So.
No. It's extremely valid. Great points. And so as it goes forward, it's really this, you know, the Sisters' abilities and what they've given them. Sure, they took away some things that I think people were very comfortable with, and I get it. But I also think that the Dominions getting that one deal back, there's so much maneuverability to that it's a really big deal. It's a game. I don't want to say game breaking, but it is it's powerful.
We talked slightly about it with the Zephyrim and the Retributor squads last episode, of how some of what just makes them work isn't quite on the page anymore. You've got to kind of work for it just a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And that may cause people to shift, to change out what they're taking as we thirst and scramble for that efficiency.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that sentiment. I think the same thing could be said that we said for Zephyrim can really be said for Repentia. Repentia seemed, with just Repentia with CP, you got essentially, with the exception of Fight First, you had every possible buff that a melee unit could have. They had an advance and charge with miracle dice to prop up both the advance and the charge. They had rerolls to hit in combat. They had exceptionally good options for what their offensive profiles were. They had the ability to do mortal wounds when they died, and they had the double attack. And now they've lost a bunch of those things, and a lot of those things have been removed and placed into where I thought they should have been originally, which is on the Repentia Superior. Because it always scratched my head, was just like, why does that character exist? Surely they she should have some purpose. And now a lot of those things are on her. So she gives the aura of advance and charge, and she gives a lot of that other offensive stuff to help them out, which is the whole point of that character existing and the Repentia existing. She's guiding them back to repentance and like becoming full-fledged Sisters again after they go through their time of being absolutely bonkers.
We can talk about the Rapacious Superior for a second, if you guys would like. So Scourge of the Penitent, if your army is battle-forged, and for each detachment that includes a Sister Rapacia unit, one Rapacious Superior can be included in the detachment without taking up a battlefield role slot. We haven't seen that, I don't think, play as much as often in this edition.
Yeah, it's definitely been toned down. I mean, I remember a lot of it for my Ravenwing stuff. If I take Black Knights, I get a single one of the Black Knight Command stuff without a slot. I think there's a couple other ones, like Crypto Thralls don't take up a slot if you've got like a Chronomancer or whatever. But there's a few other bits and pieces. But you're right, it's not a huge amount of it.
So Driven Onwards is the next role. In your command phase, you can select one friendly Order Sister Rapacia unit within 3 inches of this model. If you do so until the end of the turn, this model and that unit are both eligible to declare a charge in a turn in which they advanced. And until the end of the turn, each time a charge roll is made for this model or that unit, roll one additional d6 and discard one of the results.
Really good. Really good. You're just going to take it. If you want to play like you did before, you're going to take one, maybe two of these now.
I like how it applies to the unit and this model.
Yeah.
That's some elegance in design, if you ask me. The next rule is Overseer of Redemption. It's an aura. While a friendly Order Sister Rapacia unit is within 6 inches of this model, each time a model in that unit makes a melee attack, add one to the wound roll.
You want to talk about value from one character? Like, those are two of the best auras out there. And this is not an expensive character. I'm just having a
40 points
now. Yeah, 40 points.
You're 40 points like, oh, for four wounds, 3+ save.
Five attacks.
Three, of course. Yeah, but
five. Let me say it again. Five attacks on this character.
With the neural whips, each time an attack is made with his weapon against a unit, excluding vehicles, if no models in the target unit have a leadership characteristic of 8 or more, add 1 to that attack's wound roll. So potentially wounding a lot of things on fours.
And so this is the thing, though. People say, oh, no, I've got to take a tax character. This isn't a tax character. This is a beater. She goes in there and she slaps as well. She might not go after or hunt the same things as well as the Rapacia do. But, you know, if you're going into one wound stuff, she's just as good as a bunch of Rapacia.
Well, can I like support that by saying you don't have to attack the same thing that Rapacia's attack? Because
true.
You know, there's what we see is that there are smaller units that are performing actions, holding down pieces of the board, trying to get positional things for secondary objectives and that kind of stuff. And a five attack character hitting on threes that also happens to buff a really stout unit on the side is not a bad investment. Yeah, I don't believe so anyway. I mean, that's we'll see how it all plays out, what makes it into some of these lists. But I think now, if you were wanting to play the Rapacia still, and they are still a good unit because they do have two attacks apiece hidden on threes. Granted, the Eviscerator has a -1 from the hit roll, but you know they still punch just as hard as they did in the past.
Yeah, and I want to point something out. Back to what I think Red and I both remember is why the Rhino Russ was quite terrifying. There's no limitations for the Dominions when they scout a transport for having anything else in that transport. So you can have five Dominions in a Rhino with five Rapacia, scout move them up, and just first turn charge Rapacia into people's faces. You won't have a big unit, so unit of five. We're not going to get ahead of ourselves, or the sky is falling about, you know, 20 Death Company doing something crazy to us like that, which they could before. Little surgical five-man Rapacias coming up and just messing with your plans. And I think it's a nice little cheeky play there that you might see people doing.
So the Rapacia do also have the Zealot rule, which allows them to re-roll their hit rolls when they charge or heroic intervention or war charge.
The other side of that, if you didn't want to use Rapacia for that, I think there's a pretty good excuse to take quite a few Celestian Sacrosants. We already lost our minds over those last week, but also Arcoflagellants. I'm a big fan of Arcoflagellants again, especially in this bustling meta, which might see quite a few more 20-man squads here, there, and everywhere, most of them having only one wound. So yeah, Arcoflagellants might see a bit of a resurgence.
I know we don't normally like comment about what's sold out or not sold out, but the Sacrosants didn't sell out.
That's outrageous to me.
I think they're good. So get as many as you need or as many as you want. But
we called it with Morven Vala, didn't we? Like instantly sold out, instantaneous, gone. Yeah. I've even had mates who've talked to my sister's players in my local area. I've talked to the stores around our area, and they're like, we're getting one, like, you know, a non-GW FLGS said we're getting one for our shelf. Apart from that, everything has gone from the pre-order.
Oh, well, they're beautiful models. So yes.
And Morven Vala, just, you know, oh, cool. It's a High Lord of Terror and she's incredible on the table. Why wouldn't you want to own it?
Yes. Agreed. Sorry, I didn't want to sidetrack you from the arcoflagellants.
Oh no, no problems. Like arcoflagellants, they've been quietly good, but I think we were just fighting the wrong profiles for them to really take off. Like they weren't stellar into marine bodies. Like, you know, they were quite good into things like Necron Warriors. They were quite good into things like Poxwalkers, things of that ilk. But they did struggle against the marine bodies. So I think we might see them coming back more as people find small pocket solutions for stuff like 20-man ranger units, maybe other 20-man sisters units, things of that ilk. And I assume this train of everyone kind of maybe wanting to take one brick of like 20 infantry might be a theme for this edition. We might see the same thing come through for guard, might see the same thing come through for Tyranids, Orcs, etc. So arcoflagellants are my little Adam's little ring-a-ding hot take for you might see quite a few more of them soon.
Well, I think when you compared just stat for stat, page for page to the Rapintia, they were always outclassed. Like you couldn't, when you were putting them both on a scale, you know, the Rapintia always tipped the scales. So what do you think is putting the Arcoflagellants back into some type of consideration?
Just a bucket of attacks they can bring to bear. Their weapon skill 4+ are not incredible, but do come with Zealot. And there are some other ways and means to circumnavigate that. They come with 2 attacks base. And each time an attack is made with this weapon, which is strength +1, -1 AP, 1 damage, you make 2 hit rolls instead of 1. And there is a stratagem to make it to have 3 base attacks, I believe. So they got 6 attacks each with rerolls to hit. And then they have a couple of special rules. Berserk killing, each time a model in unit would lose a wound. They have a 5+ feel no pain. And this unit cannot perform any actions, of course, as the vanilk of, you know, something as bonkers as essentially a flail with a mechanical attachment to it.
I think you said 6 attacks a piece. 4 attacks, 2 attacks base.
Yeah, I believe there's ways to give them bonus attacks. I think it's a stratagem for them. I'll double check that if you guys want to talk about Arcos for a minute.
But with that, they've got a pretty big drawback, though. This instrument of pain and penance, the unit cannot perform any actions as described in the Warhammer 40,000 core book. Does that even matter? I mean, look, you don't want these just hanging out on the battlefield. You want them charging into things.
Agreed.
So does that even matter?
I think that it's a design. You know, you can see the intent of the designers behind it, and that so it's no longer as Adam mentioned, it's no longer one of these smaller units that's just out there accomplishing actions for you in the background. Mm. When the game intent for them is exactly to your point, Paul, that it's supposed to be. You're supposed to just throw them forward and get them into the fight kind of deal.
Yeah.
I think it's good.
And their toughness 4 with 2 wounds, which makes that 5 of feel no pain quite relevant. And there are ways to give them +2 invuln as well. So they'll have a 5+ invuln and a 5+ feel no pain, the use of things like Inquisitors and some other bits and pieces. But that stratagem I was talking about is called Extremist Trigger Word. It's 1 CP. You use stratagem in the fight phase when an arcoflagellant unit from your army is selected to fight. Till the end of the phase, change the ability of all arcoflail models in the unit. They are equipped with the following. Each time an attack is made with this weapon, make 3 hit rolls instead of 1. At the end of the phase, roll 1d6 for each model in that unit. On a 1, a model in that unit is destroyed. So it's probably it wasn't +1 attack there.
No,
+1 attacks.
You can get enduring implants on 1 model. So that'd be 9 attacks on that model.
Pretty good still. Still pretty good.
Yeah, and they start out base 13 points, and then 5 points for that enduring implant. Mm. So that makes one of them 18 points. And I got to think, for 5 points on 1 model, for an extra attack and extra strength, probably worth it.
Probably, yeah, probably do it on 1 model. The other way to get a plus attack is through the new Hymns of Battle, which essentially is like litanies that chaplains do, but for the priests. In the Adeptus Sororitas army. And so the first one, the one that they all know, I think it's Canticle of Hate or Litany of Hate for chaplains, which gives an aura of rerolls to hit. Their one is War Hymn. And I'll read it out. If this hymn is inspiring, select one friendly Adeptus Ministerum Corps or character or engine of redemption unit within 6 of this priest and add 1 to the attack characteristics of models in that unit. So that's another way to buff up and beef up those attacks. So they'd go to 8 attacks, so they get 3 from the trigger word, 1 per 3, and then so they would go to 9 each. And then you'd go to 12 on that one guy? Yeah, yikes. You don't need a big unit of these. If I was making a Sisters Codex, a Sisters army now, I'd maybe have 1 big squad of Rapentia and then 1 5-man squad of Rapentia, and then some Zephyrum, some Seraphim, which are both extremely good still. And then I have 1 unit of 5 arcoflagellants. And at the start of the game, I've got my 1 unit of minions in the Rhino and 1 unit of minions in the Immolator. And then I'm like, which do I want to send in the Rapentia or the arcoflagellants this turn? Because what am I up against, you know? Are they Marines? If they're Marines, the Rapentia go in and pick up 5 infiltrators that'll stop me, you know, scouting, moving in and auto-charging Zephyrum later in the game. Or if they're playing like, you know, Admech and they've got 20 Rangers, you know, 5 arcoflagellants. just will take, well, maybe kill them all, you know, depending on how you roll with the four plus to hit and the rest, and you chuck them in, send them in instead. I think it's a really cool little combo you can do there. I love it.
I think if you're building this from scratch now, I think two Dominion squads are auto includes.
Close to. The issue is, so a funny thing happened, the Zephyrim got pulled out from the elite slot, which was ultra congested. Like, that elite slot was phenomenally congested. And now they're in the fast attack slot, which, because of the buff to Dominions, feels congested as well, because you've got Dominion, Seraphim, and Zephyrim now, and they're all units that I feel like you might want to take.
The Zephyrim still, you think, even without their, like, the little slightly change to their data slate?
I think they're fine. I think they're absolutely fine. Maybe you don't take 10 mans. Maybe you don't put them in to think you're going to try and kill somebody's Death Star anymore, or go after people's, you know, bricks of Lich Guard, etc. But they're still phenomenally good at killing anything around the same points as them. Like, they won't hit, punch up like they used to insanely, but they still do a crazy good work.
We've talked about really, you know, dense squads, 20 max out and that kind of stuff. But I think this army functions incredibly well at like heavy MSU. That means multiple small, many small units.
What do you think about that, Red? Do you think this is they're leaning towards Horde or MSU or somewhere in the middle?
I think that the Sisters have that, you know, we talked about the flexibility of being, you know, there's not a bad unit in the Codex. I think they could go either way. We saw with MSU, we talk about the war suits and exactly what you guys are getting to, some of these, the ability to have smaller units and then bound in with the Dominions, bringing in, you know, small units of Repentia and so on and so forth. I think that they have a lot of play if you want to go that direction. But I also think that they especially with a lot of the overlapping buffs and everything that they have and the excellent weapon loadouts that they have available to them, I think that they could play larger units as well. And I don't think that players, we talk about some of the cookie cutter builds and whatnot. And Paul, you mentioned that treasure hunt for efficiency. I think that it's a trap to think that there's a cookie cutter deal, which people will fall into, right? Because you see what works and you want to build on it. And that's like not just in war games alone. That's something that people do anyways. But I think that there's a trap to that. I think that this brings up a really good point that there's so many different avenues to explore. And as you play into the meta and your local area, you don't need to feel pinned into just playing Sisters a specific way. I think that there's a lot of different things to take advantage of personally.
I 100% agree. And the biggest way I agree with that is I don't think Bloody Rose is the auto take anymore. I think there's a conversation to be had there. There are really good other options.
Let's have that conversation after the break.
No, Paul, I won't have it now.
See you in a minute.
FTN is brought to you by Discount Games Inc. Please visit them at www.discountgamesinc.com. And don't forget to ask Jay about ways to save even more on your hobby projects.
Hey everybody, we are back. Still got Adam and Red here.
Hey.
Yo.
Let's talk about a couple of orders. Like, again, I know we're bouncing around, but it's a kind of a weighty book. Lots of things to discuss. Lots of combinations.
I actually feel like it's better to do it like this. If we can't do the whole book, it's probably better just give people a snapshot of the bits and pieces that, you know, that we find interesting, and hopefully they echo the sentiment. But I want to talk about two of the orders that I think are legitimately very takeable. Because like we said before, maybe you saw a little bit of Valorous Heart adjoined to Bloody Rose, but I think everything was mono Bloody Rose or mostly Bloody Rose, yeah?
Yeah, Bloody Rose allowed you to kind of audible your battlefield capabilities. And so I think if you were kind of agnostic about what you were a fan of, it was an easy pick.
Yeah, agreed. The first one I want to talk about is Argent Shroud. I'll just quickly read out what you get for this one. And this is the one that I believe people might want to lean into if they like the MSU flavor more, because this thing is really good for that. Each time a unit with this conviction makes a normal move or advances in your movement phase, to the end of your shooting phase, it counts as having remained stationary. So even if you advance, you count as having remained stationary. And then each time a unit with this conviction is selected to shoot or fight, you can roll one hit roll or one rune roll when resolving that unit's attacks. So that's the better half of, so that's a better version of kind of what we got when Master Artisans got downgraded, because it used to be roll one hit and one wound. And then it was, you know, Salamanders have just got a reroll one of, you know, a wound, I think. And then some people just get reroll a hit. These guys you can choose. You can reroll one hit or one wound. And so it's really quite nice. And where I think this gets really potent is having like one multi-melter in a unit of five sisters. Because all of a sudden, that unit of five sisters can move and advance, still shoot that multi-melter at as if it remains stationary, so still hit on threes, e.g., it's turning the multi-melter into an assault weapon and giving that multi-melter plus one to hit, and it gets a reroll to hit or reroll to wound. So if you wanted to play MSU and just maximize this, this is the way to go. I think this thing is amazing.
I mean, man, I'm fishing for sixes on my Dominion squad.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, you can fish for a six if you need to. A bunch of other things. This would really activate an MSU army, wouldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, again, you said it before, I said it before, I think we've all hit it. Like, there's nothing pinning the sisters into a single build, and this really helps demonstrate that by having the Bloody Rose or this one in order to be able to play up more this style of play versus the other. It's really great that the design concepts are allowing for so much flexibility.
Exactly right. And we know where Miracle Dice can come in and just make things like bunch of little pocket hitting multi melters just activate in any one turn and just start popping off. There's another really cool strat that goes along with these guys where if you use a miracle dice for a hit roll, you automatically get to use that miracle dice for a wound roll. And so you think about the applications versus somebody like Mortarion, who's both very hard to hit because usually he'll miasma himself, so he'll be forced to hit, and then he'll be forced to wound for something like a multi melter. So if you just got a four in your miracle dice pile for one CP, you just got an attack that auto hits and auto wounds Mortarion, and that is just some really powerful things. Like, miracle dice haven't gone down in power. They're all the same applications. You get a little bit less of them than you did. Like, there's, you know, things like the Triumph aren't giving you like two every battle round. Things like the Battle Sanctum aren't automatically giving you miracle dice anymore, but you're still going to have a bunch.
We should talk about the generation of miracle dice. So gaining miracle dice, and if every unit from your army has Adeptus Auritas keyword, then at the start of each battle round, you gain one miracle dice. At the end of a phase in which any of the following conditions were met, you gain one miracle dice. And that's Vengeance, any Adeptus Auritas unit from your army, destroy one or more enemy units, and then Sacrifice, which is each time you gain, any Adeptus Auritas character unit from your army is destroyed. And it goes on to say, note, the miracle dice can also be gained via other rules, no matter the source. You can only gain miracle dice from such a rule if every unit in your army is the Adeptus Auritas keyword. Or, Cult Imperialis, Agent of the Imperium, or Unaligned. And then it goes on to say how to determine what the score of that miracle dice is. So slightly different than it was before, but you are going to generate them, yes.
Yeah, slightly less than you before, because a lot of people were taking a lot of things that would just automatically give them miracle dice. Like I mentioned, things like the Triumph, etc. But look, they're still one of the best, and the people claim most broken portions or mechanics in the game, which I kind of agree. I can see the argument. You're playing a dice game, and there's a faction that doesn't use dice.
Well,
they just get to automatically have things, but you still have to roll that dice.
I never felt like the Sisters player before was ever going to conceivably run out of miracle dice.
That's
it. And now it feels like it's a little bit more of a decision, especially when you factor in those miraculous character upgrades that we talked about last episode.
Yeah, exactly right. So the other order I wanted to talk about was Sacred Rose.
Well, let's go down their whole thing. Yeah, because every order, every sub-faction they've got their tactics that applies to everything, and then they've got a stratagem that applies to them. Then there's a warlord trait, and then typically a relic that's unique to them.
I call it the package. You get your chapter package or your doctrine, your dynasty package, and you got to look at it all as like a, you know, you get your free, when, you know, you buy in for the the pyramid scheme, you get your steak knives, you get your,
So the Argent Shroud, this is the, I think, faction color scheme is that, I think they have the silver metallic armor, like kind of the shiny silver metallic armor.
I would honestly not have a clue, and that's probably a shame on me.
Dude, I understand, and I don't think many people necessarily are. So really, they're your toys. Paint them however you want. Seeing if you are wanting to stick to the canon here, that's what you might want to go with. And their symbol is a skull with like a halo around it, a halo of spikes around it.
Looks quite a bit like a Sanguinary Guard symbolism. This is your faction, Paul.
Yeah.
This is you.
So the stratagem is a 1 CP Faces or Shield. Use the stratagem in any phase when an order of the Argent Shroud model from your army would lose a wound as a result of a mortal wound until the end of that phase. Each time that model or any other model in its unit would lose a wound as a result of a mortal wound, on a roll of a d6 of a 4+, that wound is not lost. Build in a little smite protection there.
And there's a lot more mortal wounds out there than I believe there ever has been, except for the start of 8th edition. Start of 8th edition, there was this ridiculous amount of mortal wounds coming out. Then they toned it back, and it's kind of been here and there with specific armies. But now kind of every army has a way of just splashing a bunch of mortal wounds. Like I'm thinking Hellions doing the flybys or the bombers. Admech have got a bunch of ones now, especially with Wrath of Mars still being pretty good. So yeah, it's not a bad thing to have.
You talk about if you take in 20 model units, then think of the value that you're getting off that one CP. If they're in that situation to just kind of hoover up all those abilities from your opponent. Because remember, Smite's closest visible target for most armies.
Yeah, so you get to have some say in who's going to get by it.
Yeah. Warlord trait, selfless heroism. This warlord is eligible to perform a heroic intervention if it is within 6 inches horizontally and 5 inches vertically of any enemy unit instead of the 3 inches horizontally or 5 inches vertically. Each time this warlord makes a heroic intervention move, it can move up to 6 inches. All other rules for heroic intervention still apply. The next bullet point is, at the start of the fight phase, if this warlord is within engagement range of any enemy units, it can fight first that phase.
Pretty good. I mean, it may not be the best one because it doesn't really force multiply, but I'm going to point out a stratagem that I believe goes along with this warlord trait that people should know about because it is amazing. So there is a strat called, it's very similar to the one, what's the one in for Blood Angels, Paul, that makes everybody have to attack a certain character?
Something about Martyr of Sanguinius or some Blood of the Martyr or something like that. It's where the character says, all eyes on me, essentially. So if they're engaged with another unit, they have to fight that character.
So this one's called Suffering and Sacrifice. It's 1 CP. You just strat him in the fight phase. Select one Adeptus Aureus Warlord, Saint Potentia, or Living Saint unit from your army, excluding vehicles. Until the end of the phase, that unit is known as your Suffering unit. Until the end of the phase, each time an enemy unit is selected to fight, if this model is in that enemy unit's, sorry, if this model is in within engagement range of your Suffering unit, when your opponent is selected to make targets for its attacks, those targets can only target your Suffering unit. So you can put a 6-inch intervention fight first character behind your lines, leave them a gap to intervene into your front lines, and then force them all to attack that character, e.g. leaving you unmolested.
That's nice. Yeah, that's a pretty good combo.
It's pretty slick. A big fan of it, because when you pull it up, you're going to feel like such a big brain maestro, being like, ha, 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 foiled. It's pretty good.
We should get that on a t-shirt, big brain maestro.
With ha, ha, foiled on the back.
So the relic is the Quicksilver Veil. Order the Agent Shroud model only. Add 3 to the bear's move characteristic. Each time an attack is made against the bear, subtract 1 from that attack's hit roll.
Not bad in concert with the Waller trait, I guess. Because then, you know, she's great.
I like this for one big reason, as there's no way to increase the move of a cannonist, really, other
that's
than
true.
This.
That's true. But this actually does make them quite speedy, because you have miracle dice to make sure you get a good advance, and then with +3, you can actually make this, you know, 6-inch move, +3, +6. So what's that, 15? You can go 15 inches with this model. So it's not bad at all when you add it all up. But sorry, back to that stratagem. I don't want to segue us. I just thought of something. Yeah, I just had another play pop in my head. Celestine still gets back up when she dies.
That is true.
And so if you were to, let's say, run a unit of Repentia or something into a Fight's Last, or a unit of like Death Shroud, who are just going to spank him before they get to attack. Firstly, sorry, Repentia get to fight on death now for a couple of CP. But if you didn't want to do that, Celestine goes in with him. You know, everyone fights last, but you redirect all the attacks onto Celestine. Celestine dies, gets back up at the end of the turn. So you didn't waste anything. And then the Repentia fight and do the job you put him in there to do. And like the fact that you could just send Celestine in and use that stratagem on her and then let her die and bring her back for no loss. Hilarious.
So let me read that. It's the miraculous intervention. The first time Celestine is destroyed, roll 1d6 at the end of the phase. Instead of using any rules that are triggered when a model is destroyed, on a 1, this unit counts as having been destroyed for the purposes of sacrifice. On a 2+, set Celestine back up on the battlefield as close as possible to where she was destroyed and not within engagement range of any enemy units with all her wounds remaining.
And the other thing to know about Celestine is when she came out, guys? Do you remember when she came out and she was in a unit with her...
The Gemini.
What were they called? The Gemini. That's the case again. They've been recombined.
Oh. Cool.
Yep. And the life wards. While this unit contains any Gemini superior models, each time an attack successfully wounds the unit, that attack must be allocated to one of those models. The destruction of Gemini superior models is ignored for the purposes of morale test. If Celestine is ever destroyed, any remaining Gemini superior models in the unit are also destroyed.
You know, when you look at a unit's data sheet and just like, wow, that's a lot of special rules. It must be good. You're right, usually, you know?
Well, she can bring back, let's say you did that situation to where you directed all attacks to her and she's destroyed and the Gemini also go away. She can bring her back with the healing tears.
Yeah, so she comes back to life and then in your first turn, she brings back a Gemini. So she brings back her bodyguard, essentially. She's very good now. She went away a little bit in the last codex. I think people thought she was a bit too many points when you could make a basic canoness for 50 or 60, whatever points they were, have Beneficence or the Blade of Admonition or whatever it is, and be as good as her in combat. And just like, wow, I can just do it for far less points. But now I think she's really good again.
What's the next order you wanted to chat about?
So it's the next one down from that one, actually. It is
Sacred Rose.
Yeah, Sacred Rose. So tell us a bit about that, Paul.
Devout Serenity is the chapter tactic, for lack of a better term. So each time a combat attrition test is taken for a unit with this conviction, it is automatically passed. And the next bullet point is each time you use a miracle dice when a model or unit with this conviction performs an act of faith, roll a d6 on a 4+, you gain one miracle dice.
Yes. So people think about and talk about how, you know, you have Wall of Trace and things to get command points back. Like on a 5+, you'll get a command point back when you spend a stratagem. This is the one that gives you the same thing, but for miracle dice. This is not locked to getting one command point back a turn like those things are now. And you spend more than one miracle dice a turn. You can go a turn and spend, you know, 3 or 4 miracle dice at times. And then each time you do one, you kind of get half of them back. So you kind of always have 50% more miracle dice than you seem to have, and which we know that this is the best mechanic sisters have, one of the best mechanics in the game. And so doubling and tripling down on that seems like a good choice.
The color scheme on this one is like the kind of the lightish gray armor, just so people are following along, keeping up.
Yeah. Their stratagem is very good as well. And it's one of the stratagems that goes very well with the Dominion player we were talking about. It's called
the Emperor's Judgment. Yeah. One CP uses stratagem in your shooting phase when an order of the Sacred Rose unit from your army is selected to shoot. Until the end of the phase, each time an attack is made with a ranged weapon by a model in that unit, an unmodified hit roll of 6 scores 1 additional hit.
Yeah. And if we forgot to point out before, that mortal wound triggering ability, that the Blessed Bolt, triggers off the hit roll, not the wound roll. So you've just got 16 dice from the 4 Storm Bolters, and any hit roll of a 6 is 2 mortal wounds and the attack sequence ends. It's not the wound roll, which is why it is so good and so likely to get you those 6 mortal wounds. If we forgot to point that out before, I can't remember if we did.
Well, use it. Use it every time you can.
Every time.
I mean, look, play the odds. I don't care if you're firing at a 3-man intercessor squad. Try to get those mortal wounds in.
But keep going through the package, Paul. There's a couple other really interesting things here.
So the Warlord trait, Light of the Divine, once per turn when this Warlord performs an act of faith, one miracle dice used in that act of faith is considered to be a 6, irrespective of its actual value. That's only one bullet point. The next one is, this Warlord has the following ability, Light of the Divine, Aura. While a friendly Order of Sacred Rose core unit is within 6 inches of this Warlord, if that core unit falls back, then it is still eligible to shoot this turn.
So yeah, both of those bullet points are pretty good, but it's the fallback and shoot aura that I think is the money here. What do you think?
So is that, so that aura, and I know you just said aura, so I feel like my next question is going to be kind of silly. Can you say that again as far as that last part of that aura? Was that every unit or was that pick a unit?
While a friendly Order of the Sacred Rose core unit is within 6 inches of this Warlord, if that core unit falls back, then it is still eligible to shoot this turn. So it's not, you don't pick one, it's anybody who happens to be in the range. I think set up a particular set of circumstances, but yeah, it's not limited to one unit.
Sure. And so, you know, we talked about Bloody Rose and its melee capabilities and what it can bring to it. And then you look at this and it's like, you know, would you like an army that can fall back and shoot without real significant penalty? Well, then, you know, here's the order for you. And it's I mean, that, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but like the sisters have enough shooting. We just finished talking about what the Dominions can bring and their special loadouts, and then now you have this ability, and we go back to this balance between MSU or number of models. You know, if you did fill up those Dominion transports with 10 Dominion, you have those Blade of Wounds that you could accept a counter charge and still be able to fall back and pull this off to such an extent. I mean, it's pretty pretty intense. And I don't think that it should be overlooked. I think that's a really good point. Between the Warlord trait and what you pointed out, Adam, I think that's really good.
You can move the Warlord first to get into range of this and then move the unit.
And that warlord gets to use an act of faith per turn that automatically becomes a six. So if you need to get a 6-inch advance to get them within range of this aura, you just have it. No matter what miracle dice you have, it's a six. So the range that you can bring this aura to bear is exponentially increased. Top of that, do you know where it's amazing needing a six? Is when you've got a four up invulnerable save on your warlord and she's got one wound left. And you're like, well, I've only got a two here. It's a shame that that's now a six. Bang, you know, job done.
And you have one wound left because you took that relic that allows you to only take one wound each time.
It's really good. The relic is here is a bit of a meme, but it's very funny.
So their specialty relic is the Light of Saint Agathina, Order of the Sacred Rose models, with a brazier of holy fire only. This relic replaces the brazier of holy fire and has the following profile: Light of Saint Agathia, 12-inch range, assault D6. No strength, no AP, no damage. Each time an attack is made with his weapon, the attack automatically hits the target, and on unmodified wound roll of 4+ or 2+, if the target contains any demon models, the target suffers one mortal wound and the attack sequence ends.
So, like, realistically, you're going to do two mortal wounds if you're lucky against most things, but against demons, she's just like such a pain to charge. Like, D6 mortal. Well, essentially, you're going to be doing close to D6 mortal wounds to them when they charge it, which I think is pretty spicy in the right meta, in the right environment, or when you just want to be a bit of a jerk to your friend in the garage game. But it's pretty cute.
That's exactly what I was thinking. It's like, what? So your opponent is playing their Bloodthirster. And they finally get through all the mortal wound, bolter, fire, and everything else and charge your warlord. Mm-hmm. And you're like, you know what? Take some Light of Saint Agathia.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. But so those are the two that I really like. And I don't know if I like them more than Bloody Rose, but I think they're very up there in consideration. Red, for your mind and the way you like to play the game, I feel like Sacred Rose is right up there for you.
It can be, because there's the maneuverability. There's everything that's there to get you there. And I do think that it carries forward into it. If I was going to do, I think that Sisters in Blood Red and Gold look pretty good. So I totally think that if I was ever inclined to do it, there's a high chance that I would run with something along those lines. And the Repentia, of course, I mean, to be able to play into that, there's just no wrong way to go about it. And think of all, we talked about it before, all of the filigree and the decoration that goes to a lot of the Sisters material can very quickly transfer over into the chaos-y baroqueness. And so a lot of this I struggle with because don't get me wrong, I obviously
look at the chaos lens.
I have to look at it through that to a certain extent, but at the same time, you know, there are some Imperial forces that are near and dear to my heart. Sisters just, and I think it has to do with, I was kind of letting them flesh out, and we talked about in the last episode about how really this codex has brought forth maybe what they had always intended from the beginning. And I think that it there's enough in it at this point to tempt me towards considering Sisters even. I still think I'd have to play them with some chaosy flair to them, but that along with the Sacred Rose, I think that there's a lot to that.
And I just want to push the point, the miracle dice, getting back the miracle dice on a 4+, can't be overstated how crazy that could be in flipping a game at any point. Just flip a game based on having twice as many miracle dice, and every multi-melter gets a miracle dice and all this other crazy stuff.
I mean, Paul said it before, right? It's a game where we roll dice. And
yeah,
when it comes to game designing and you have a faction that can just throw with miracle dice, you can throw some of that out the window. Like you actually have far more agency in some of those hinge moment dice rolls that it's actually hard to account for just the exact, you know, what a player can control.
Yeah, and it makes it really hard for your opponent to account for all the variables possibly coming their way, like, or what can happen to me in my next turn? What do I need to prepare for? And then you look at the fact they're going to have, you know, possibly four or five more miracle dice than they have right now, and you don't know what those numbers are, and all of a sudden you're like, okay, they could charge two more units than I think, and, you know, shooting their multi-melters can do just flat six damage here, there, and everywhere. And yeah, it gets pretty scary. But onto your point about the chaos bits, I'm looking at the Pennant engines and the Mortifiers right now. They literally look like a demon engine. Like, there's nothing more chaosy than what those things are.
I sense heresy.
Let's get an exoskeleton, yeah? And, like, instead of it's instead of like putting them inside the exoskeleton, let's slap them on the front, baby. Like, how much more chaos can you get? Well, it's so good.
Let's talk about the Order of the Ebon Chalice before we jump to, or may potentially wrap this show up. The Order of the Ebon Chalice, the start of that package is, if any units in your army have this conviction when you are determining which sacred rites are active for your army, after you've determined your mission, you cannot randomly select two sacred rites. Instead, after you have selected one sacred rite, you must then select a second. Both of these sacred rites are active for units from your army with this conviction.
And for people who may have forgotten, the sacred rites are the mono-faction bonus, like the exploding sixes or the plus one advance and charge or the better deny the witch and stuff.
That's it. Only the first is active for other units from your army with the sacred rites ability. Each time a model or unit with this conviction performs an act of faith, you can first discard one miracle dice. If you do so, one miracle dice you use in that act of faith is considered to be a six, irrespective of the actual value. So you want to get rid of your ones and twos.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good way to cycle that out. Now you're cycling at double the rate, but wait, there's more coming up. The stratagem here is the cleansing flames. Use this stratagem in your shooting phase when an Order of the Ebon Chalice unit from your army is selected to shoot until the end of the phase. Add 4 inches to the range of all flame weapons that model in that unit are equipped with. That's the first bullet point. Second bullet point is, each time a model in that unit makes an attack with a flame weapon, on an unmodified wound roll of 4+, the target suffers one mortal wound in addition to any normal damage. A maximum of 3 mortal wounds can be inflicted per phase via this stratagem. So lower cap on this, but pretty remember good. You're firing D6. The Ministorum Flamer is 12 inches, so yeah, you could be firing a 16-inch hand flamers, or normal flamers.
I just want to point out a stratagem that can go alongside with that called Cleanse by Fire. You use a stratagem in your shooting phase when an Adeptus Ministorum unit from your army is chosen to shoot with. Till the end of the phase when a model in that unit shoots with a flame weapon, do not roll to determine the amount of attacks made with the weapon. Instead, you get the maximum number. So, yes, please, 16-inch range auto 6-shot flamers that can do mortals on top. Yes, please, very much.
Immolation flamers are 18-inch base.
Mm.
So if you're taking the immolators like we've kind of, you know, backed, I think, in the beginning of the show.
Yep. I like having one in your army. I think they're cute. I think I like them in that role.
Well, so here's where we start talking about that value here, the warlord trait, terrible knowledge. If this warlord is on the battlefield, the miracle dice you gained at the start of the first battle round is automatically a 6.
Mwah, already awesome.
But while this warlord is on the battlefield, each time you spend a command point to use a stratagem, you can roll a one d6 on a 5+, that command point is refunded. So if you're worried about being a little thirsty for command points,
yeah, not so worried anymore. That's just a good value combo, isn't it?
I think, yeah, I mean, getting that first six, that way you've banked it, and like you can almost like smugly let your opponent know that you have a 6 in your back pocket.
That's right.
It's true.
It's huge.
And, you know, it's big for doubling down on Alpha Strike or hanging, like you just said, Paul, like a sword of Damocles. You know, what am I going to do with this 6 I automatically get? Oh, but the relic is hilarious. Sorry, can you read out the relic for me?
Yeah, sure thing. So the Annunciation of the Creed, Order of the Ebon Chalice, models equipped with a Condemner bolt gun only. This relic replaces a Condemner bolt gun and has the following profile. Bolt gun, range 24 inches, rapid fire 1, strength 4, no AP, damage 1, or with a blessed stake, assault 1, strength 4, neg 2 AP, D2. Before selecting targets, select one or both of these profiles above to make attacks with. If you select both, then each time an attack is made with this weapon this phase, subtract 1 from the attack's hit roll. Each time you select a target with this weapon, ignore the lookout cert roll. Each time an attack with this weapon's blessed stake profile is allocated to a Psyker model, the model's unit suffers 3 mortal wounds in addition to the normal damage.
So just to paint the picture here, at some point, like, you know, this character puts a literal piece of wood, a stake, in her like grenade launcher, and then when she points it at a Psyker, doesn't even shoot it at the Psyker, the Psyker takes 3 mortal wounds. They look at her and just, like, out of sheer fear of getting staked, they take 3 mortal wounds. Because it's before the hit roll, before the wound roll, when you allocate the attack to them.
Allocated an attack.
Out of sheer fear of this piece of wood, they're like, and 3 mortal wounds of damage occur. It's so funny.
Look, it's an accurate stake.
It's a very accurate stake. But man,
and you don't even have to be that close either.
It's 24 inches, and there's there are still a lot of four wound, three or four wound psychers out there. Astropaths spring to mind, just like auto kill an astropath for looking at it. That seems pretty powerful. Seems pretty good. The actual real life applications is like, you know, three games out of 20. This is going to be fun, and the rest of them are just like, well, I paid for a okay bolt gun, I guess.
Well, yeah, I think there are some better relics you could possibly choose, but if you're going into a Psyker heavy meta, then why not?
Yeah, well, you know, just kill a paladin, like a three wound paladin, three wound terminator from Grey Knights. Like, well, this stake looked at you wrong. One of them's dead. That seems pretty cute.
Right in the jugular. Speaking of relics, yeah. Before we wrap up, I want to talk about the Iron Surplus of Saint Estella. Add one to the bearer's wound characteristic. That's the first bullet point. Second one is each time an attack is made against the bearer, an unmodified wound roll of 1-3 for that attack fails, irrespective of any abilities that the weapon or the models making the attack may have. And then the bearer has a save characteristic of 2+.
Ooh, that's 3 dot points of goodness.
Yep. Only restriction is has to be an Adeptus Aureatus model.
Plus 1 wound, permanent transhuman, save characteristic of 2+. How much of a bigger deal is something like transhuman on a T3 model rather than a T4 or a T5 for custodes?
I mean, the stats alone and just how much more frequently you're going to see that 2 or 3, I'd like to graph it out even if I had the time, but to sit there and paint it out, I mean, it really does just cut off so much advantage that people go into it because, and people do it at some, you know, offhand, okay, well, it's a T3 model. I can go in, I can do this. And transhuman just really catches, don't get me wrong, no one undervalues transhuman. Mm. People know how good it is, right? But it really is accentuated when it comes to these weaker models where those wounds are so typical to occur. It's just that much higher of a chance being T3 versus, like you said, you know, T5, for example. Mm. And so it is really a big deal. It is. And it just so many things can get wasted because of that.
I see it's buying time.
I played against Custodes a bunch in this edition, and I see them use their transhuman like against my Plasma Inceptors, and that's pretty much it. Because only the Plasma Inceptors have enough dump of like things hitting, wounding them on threes that it's actually worth giving them what translates to a -1 to wound. But for something like a sister model, you think about all the armies in the game that haven't come out that spam high strength weaponry. I'm talking Tau, talking Craftlord Eldar, where like strength 6 and strength 5 is the mainstay. Stuff like transhuman on toughness 3 units just goes like, wow, this is so powerful.
Agree 100%. And I also think you look at these relics, like some of the ones that we've highlighted, and I mean, look, it depends on what you want to gear out your characters to do. But I see it as buying time. I mean, you know, we have a finite number of turns we play this game. If you can increase the longevity of some of these characters, then they are potentially paying out either because of their auras or objectives or something like that. And these things, I think, greatly increase the stamina of the characters.
Yeah, I think that's really well said as well.
That's really the main stuff I wanted to cover. This book is it's deep.
Mm.
I think we've talked about some good stuff and talked about some combos, but those are just some of the things you can do with this book.
Yeah, I think there's a good case to be playing these guys any way you want, Horde, MSU, Mechanized. There's some good cases for all the options, and I think GW have done a really good job with this book.
Yeah, I like it how I can look. It's like, oh man, you know, I really want to play with that model or that unit or that, you know, whatever. Like, there's you have some. I don't think you're locked into one archetype with this, and I don't think you have to make massive changes either. I think you can kind of rotate out a few things at a time, depending on either what's on your hobby desk or whatever.
Yeah, I think you can. So what I'm happy to say about this is a codex you can play for a couple of years. Like a best example, I think, is what we in Red said previously about the Necron Codex. Like, people got, unfortunately, quite bored of the previous, not the current one, the previous Necron Codex after like 6 months, when they realized every army started, you know, with 750 points already purchased in Doomsday Arcs and the required characters, etc. But this feels like you could play this for a couple of years without getting bored. And I think that's really a great testament to it. So, and the same goes for the last two codexes as well. I think Admech and Drakari are in exactly the same vein. And you can play these happily for a whole edition without feeling like you need a psychic awakening or, you know, a significant patch fix in anything. You're just going to be like, oh, well, I can just play this instead or this instead. Always something interesting to do.
Yeah, that's very well said. And I think that you're exactly right. And I'm kind of looking forward. I need to go into brew mode. Like, I've got what I think is a pretty stout Admech list that I've enjoyed enjoyed playing with. And that that Adeptus Orientis kill team that I started towards the middle of 2020 has really expanded a bit. And I don't know, I haven't built any Dominion squads yet, but I think this is going to be the first ones I've put together.
Awesome.
Yeah, we'll see. Well, hey, gentlemen, thanks for joining me this week.
Thank you.
My pleasure as always, mate.
Really appreciate everyone that's listened to us. Please leave us those 5-star reviews. It goes a long way to help other people find us. And yeah, thanks for everybody hanging in until the end of the show. We'll see y'all next week.
See ya.
Make my day.